The left is always inclined to look on the grim side of things. Always inclined to look on the grim side of things. The cup is always half empty. Until you point out, look, it's half full. It doesn't look so bad.
Welcome to Political Gingivitis, the crazy and zany podcast for progressives who need a laugh. I'm your hostess with the mostest, Andrew Stewart, and this week we're going to try to put a smile on your face and maybe a few thoughts in your head.
I should warn you, he wrote two more in E-flat alone. Next time we'll take the festival hall. One of the great problems of the world today is undoubtedly this problem of not being able to talk to scientists because we don't understand science. They can't talk to us because they don't understand anything else, poor dears. This problem, I think it was C.P. Snow first raised it, Sir Charles Snow in private life, in his books Science and Government and so on. Mind you, I haven't read it. I'm waiting for the play to come. He says, quite rightly, he said, it's no good going up to a scientist and saying to him, as you would to anybody else, you know, good morning, how are you, lend me a quid, and so on. I mean, you just glare at you, or make a rude retort, or something. No, you have to speak to him in language that he'll understand. I mean, you go up to him, you say something like, H2SO4, Professor. Don't synthesize anything I wouldn't synthesize. and the reciprocal of pi to your good wife. Now, this he will understand. Snow says that nobody can consider themselves educated who doesn't know at least the basic language of science. I mean, things like Sir Edward Boyle's law, for example. The greater the external pressure, the greater the volume of hot air. The second law of thermodynamics. This is very important. I was somewhat shocked the other day to discover that my partner not only doesn't know the second law, he doesn't even know the first law of thermodynamics. Going back to first principles, very briefly, thermodynamics, of course, is derived from two Greek words, thermos, meaning hot, if you don't drop it, and dynamics, meaning dynamic work. And thermodynamics is simply the science of heat and work and the relationships between the two, as laid down in the laws of thermodynamics, which may be expressed in the following simple terms. After me, Doc. The first law of thermodynamics. Heat is work, and work is heat.
Heat is work, and work is heat.
Very good. The second law of thermodynamics. Heat cannot of itself pass from one body to a hotter body.
Heat cannot of itself pass from one body to a hotter body.
Heat won't pass from a cooler to a hotter.
Heat won't pass from a cooler to a hotter.
You can try it if you like, but you'd far better not.
You can try it if you like, but you'd far better not.
Cos the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a ruler.
Cos the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a ruler.
Because the hotter body's heat will pass to the cooler.
Cos the hotter body's heat will pass to
first
the cooler.
Heat is work, and work is heat, and work is heat, and heat is work. Heat will pass by conduction and
heat will pass by conduction.
Heat will pass by convection.
Heat will pass by convection.
Heat will pass by radiation.
Heat will pass by radiation.
And that's a physical law. Heat is work, and work's a curse. And all the heat in the universe is gonna cool down. Because it can't increase. Then there'll be no more work, and there'll be perfect peace.
Really?
Yeah, that's entropy, man. All because of the second law of thermodynamics, which lays down that you can't pass heat from a cooler to a hotter. Try it if you like, you'd
Cause the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a rule. Cause the hotter body's heater will the pass to the hole.
Oh, you got a pass, he's a rubber cooler, you are hotter.
You can try it if you want, but you'll only look a fool. Cause the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a rule.
That's a physical law.
Oh, I'm hot.
Hot? That's because you've been working.
Oh, Beatles, nothing.
That's the first and second law of thermodynamics.
Welcome again, folks, to Political Gingivitis. I'm your host, Andrew Stewart, and today we have a special episode for you. In commemoration of the recent successful release of Raoul Peck's amazing documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, we're going to devote today's episode to the life and works of James Baldwin. First up, here is the trailer for I Am Not Your Negro. If you are watching this on YouTube, I'm actually going to have the video in the stream here for you to watch.
The future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. Then you got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that.
Welcome back. Again, we are doing a special episode today on Political Gingivitis devoted to the life and work of James Baldwin. Next up, we have a special treat. It is an audio recording made in June 1963 of James Baldwin titled Living and Growing in a White World. We thank especially the recording that was done by KQED at Castlemont High School in Oakland, California, and the broadcast at KPFA in Pacifica Radio's network. So stay tuned for this wonderful speech.
One, a baby is not born with any idea of a society, no sense whatever of other people. Its mother exists principally, in fact, entirely, for him or her, and its father exists somewhat later, entirely for him or her. It's only much, much later that the baby begins to realize that the parent on whom he depended for everything and whom he supposed held up the world is in fact just another human being who was not invented for him. That is, on the most primary level, one of the meanings of an education. On another level, it is the only way that one is enabled to enlarge the world. Now that sounds like a very grandiose phrase. All it means is that when you, for example, begin to read, you discover more about the world than you knew before. You discover more about the world in two ways, and this is why it is important. There being, in fact, two worlds. One world is you. That this envelope, I'm a world. I'm not the only world, that's my problem. But I'm a world, and I'm under the obligation to discover whatever it is that goes on in that world. And in order to do that, I have got to consent to become a social animal in order to discover and to enlarge what goes on in this world, which is all of you and many millions of people, both living and dead, past and to come. And finally, this is where it begins to be difficult, the measure of one's dignity depends on one's estimate of oneself. It really does not depend, as so many people in this country now seem to believe, on someone else's estimate. It depends, first of all, on what you take yourself to be, what your real standards are, what you think is right, what you think is wrong, what you think life is all about, what you think life is for. Now, you are all very young. And I say that, by the way, with great humility. You are all still unformed. Well, let me put it another way. You are not finally formed. And you are still, to put it brutally, I want to put it brutally because I want to make my point absolutely clear. You are still at the mercy of your elders. You are still at the mercy of the standards of your elders. Let us go back again to the whole concept of education. And bear in mind, then, that education does not and cannot occur in a vacuum. It occurs in a social context. It occurs in a social context, and it has social ends. For example, to take a very brutal example, the children of the Third Reich were educated by the Third Reich in order to fulfill the purposes of the Third Reich. Hitler did this on a very old principle, the principle referred to by priest and in the Bible, and which every parent somewhere knows. If you give me the child for 5 years, I'll have him the rest of his life. So that if that is so, one has then got to be aware that one of the purposes of an education, your responsibility before your educators, is to question the purpose of this education. Let me give you then, your education is occurring within a given context, at a certain time in history, in a certain country, at a certain time in its history. In fact, at a very crucial time in its history. If, for example, well, I'll be personal about this, when I was going to school, a school not very unlike this one, though not as pretty, I began to be bugged by the teaching of American history. I began to be bugged by the teaching of American history because it seemed that that history had been accomplished without my presence. And this had a very demoralizing effect on me when I was your age and younger, and had a demoralizing effect for quite a few years thereafter. Now, that may seem to be trivial, but speaking now as though I were your educator, as though I were your teacher, my responsibility to you would be to invest you with all of the morale that I could to prepare you for the terrible storm which is called life. Terrible and beautiful. But you must know that it is both. And you don't quite know it, and it's my responsibility to make you know it. It's my responsibility also, speaking now as your educator, to give you as true a version of your history as I can, since it is through your sense of your own history that you arrive at your identity. And no one has ever arrived at a sense of his own identity without it. This is why ancestors are important. We, all of us here now, are living through a certain kind of turmoil which endangers all of our relationships. This turmoil is sometimes described as racial. We can use that word for the moment, but it is really not racial. It is historical and it is personal. Let me speak again about the aims of a society, as opposed now to the aims of an education. The aims of a society are and always must be to inculcate in its citizens a certain sense of security and to discourage its citizens from disturbing the peace. Now, this is a necessity, and it is even an admirable necessity, because we cannot live without society, and society as a fact is a very beautiful creation. Nevertheless, it is also equally true that all societies have been brought into existence very painfully and very slowly by men, and the people who are responsible for the creation of societies must forever ask questions, all questions, take nothing whatever for granted, because that is the only way the frontiers of the world fall back, and the world, as I said before, begins to be enlarged. So that this means that though a society is under the obligation to educate all of its citizens, it is also under the obligation to discourage people from thinking too much. Now, this is where all of you come in. My responsibility, again, if I'm your teacher, is to teach you to think. This is not an easy thing to do. If I want you to think, I must teach you to think about everything. I must teach you that there is a reason for everything you do, and that you must find that reason. If, for example, and now I will be personal, I'm afraid, but I mean it in the best possible way. If I were your teacher, and let us say I was dealing with one of you who, let's say in this case, would be a Negro of about 16 or 17, and I knew that you were beginning to wonder what you were doing in school in the first place, and what waited for you outside, what good was it to be here since you, nothing that happened to you here prepared you for outside. Knowing your bitterness and not trying for a moment to pretend it is not justified, I would yet have to suggest to you that the problems that you face, you would have to make them personal. And then I would ask you very rude questions. For example, I would ask you, if you were a boy, why you dressed the way you did, and if your hair was conked, I would ask you to ask yourself, why? To come back again, this is a very small example of what I mean, to the war between society and thought. It is your responsibility as the young American citizens to understand that the standards by which you are confronted and by which many of you are visibly and obviously victimized, and others of you not so obviously but equally victimized, are not the only standards in the world. There is no reason for anybody to want to look like a Greek god. That is not the world's only standard of beauty. And furthermore, the virtues to which we all in one way or another aspire are a comfortable life, which is to say, a middle-class life, are not the only virtues. I come from a very poor family, and there's a vast amount of vitality, which is a very definite virtue, to be found in those circumstances. Finally, if I were your teacher, I would beg you to insist to fight with me and not let me get away with anything. No matter how I may sound, I am really only mortal. And though I love you very much and feel responsible for you, I'm not always right. We depend on each other, the old and the young, to learn from each other. I would beg you to ask me why, for example, your history books are the way they are. And I would beg you to force me to answer if you asked me what relevance your education had for concrete problems such as getting an apartment, moving from one part of town to another. If I were you, I would force me, I would put me on the spot, ask me the most difficult questions that you can, and I will not be able to answer them. But my responsibility is to hear them. And when you ask your question, any question, you begin to know more about what you really think. That's all I have to say. Now you're going to ask me questions.
The first question Mr. Baldwin was asked, do you think that black people in America should learn African history and culture to gain pride and dignity and strength, so when we are confronted by white people, we can say that we have a culture which is at the very least equal to white people's, and at the very most, well, we're not sure what it's equal to?
I'm going to try to answer your question as clearly as I can. It's not an easy question to answer. I can say, first of all, yes. Yes. But be careful. Find out all you can. But don't find it out with the intention of proving a point. Understand this. There is no reason for you to prove yourself to anybody except yourself. When the world talks about culture, understand this. It is not talking about culture. It is talking about power. The difference between the African cultures, which have vanished, and the European cultures, which are decaying, is that Europe had the power. And that is the only difference. It's not that Europe was civilized and Africans were not. That's a lie. Do you understand that? And find out all you can about what happened when you got here. But you haven't got to prove it to anybody. All you've got to do is know it. You're a man, baby. Please don't be shy. Go on.
What force do you think wins out most?
The next question. What force do you think wins out more often in this war about education? Society or thought?
Well, which force wins out more often? To tell you the truth? Well, I don't know. It's a question. It would seem that society wins out. And in an obvious and visible way, society usually does. After all, history is full of martyrs who went to various deaths because society didn't like what they had to say. But on the other hand, one remembers most of those people, and one does not remember all societies. So it's a question of what you think is most important. I'll tell you what I think. Thought is most important. Don't try to be safe. Nobody ever is safe.
Next, he was asked, Mr. Baldwin, in your essay to your nephew, you said the Negro has to accept those that are innocent. Can you tell us how we can distinguish those who are innocent from those who are guilty?
You got me. Wait a minute. In the essay that you're talking about, I was telling my nephew, who is you, let's say, that he had to accept these innocent people. And these innocent people are your countrymen, white Americans. I was trying to suggest to you that though this may be very hard to understand, and always will be until you die, people are not wicked because they do wicked things. I know that sounds like a terrible kind of cop-out, but the reason I want to suggest it to you is because I want you to know that there is nothing that has been done to you that you aren't capable of doing to someone else. And I don't want to see you do that. I want you, as I was trying to tell our friend over here, to realize that you got nothing to prove. And that whoever doesn't know who you are, and whoever is afraid of you, is to be pitied. And you can hope to correct him, but I beg you not to hate him. As for who is innocent and who is guilty, nobody knows. Nobody knows. That's the point. That's the best answer I can give you, but you keep thinking about it.
Mr. Baldwin, in the same book, you wrote that the terrible thing is not the whites must accept the Negroes, but that the Negroes must accept the whites. Please explain this.
I will try to explain that. Well, it's a terrible effort at some point in one's life to make, and it's a terrible effort to tell you the truth throughout one's life. And you only begin to succeed in this effort, I must say, when you reduce people to individuals and release them from the mass. The reason it's hard is because one has been, and this is not the fault of any white person that one is likely to meet, but the white culture has operated and has operated deliberately to demoralize all black people. And the demoralization has in many cases been fatal, and in all cases has been sinister. The effort, therefore, that I must make to arrive at my identity is mainly in opposition to the white force of the world. under such attention, it becomes very difficult. And then, under such attention, I must repeat, it becomes absolutely necessary to deal with people as people, only as people. Because you cannot spend your life, this is my point, trying to be revenged for historical crimes. If you do that, you will destroy yourself and you will perpetuate the crime. The thing to aim at, this is why it is a terrible necessity to accept white people, but it's a terrible necessity on the part of white people, even harder necessity to accept Negroes, because in order for white people to accept a Negro, they've got to accept their history and something much deeper and worse than that. They got to accept, if I may now be brutal and rude, but I mean this and you must think about it. If you remember that everything that you will do all your life and everything that you will say reveals you, what I call you doesn't say anything about you, or very rarely, but what I call you says everything about me. Now, there is a very good reason, which has nothing to do with Negroes, why white people call them nigger. It's a white invention. And in order for white people to be released from this invention, they will have to discover where this nigger really lives. And he lives inside white people. And they have to accept him, that stranger within, before they can accept anybody without. That is what I was trying to say.
The next question, what is your opinion of the black Muslims and other black nationalist movements?
My opinion of the black Muslim movement and other black nationalist movements, let us be precise. I would oppose with all my energy your joining such a movement for two reasons. If one is weary of the doctrine of white supremacy, and if one is cognizant of the crimes committed in the name of this myth, one cannot possibly now turn the medal over and call it black supremacy and embark on the same terrifying road, which will end up in the same place. As a black nationalist, one has got to be very careful. Words mean something. If you are a black nationalist, you must be in Africa. It is a hard fact, but it is a fact, and one has got to use it. This is your country. And no matter what you call yourself, you are an American. You have been here for 400 years, and your ancestors helped create this country. I don't think that you should abandon it for two reasons. You will not find another country, and I know because I've tried. You will simply not have this one. And you will not, to that extent that you don't have this one, you will not have yourself. And furthermore, I must beg you to remember this, to think about this very carefully. I know how enraged one can be, but at no matter what price, you must try to be clear. You can lose your temper for a second and lose 30 years of your life. Words mean something, and in that case, you must ask yourself what a black nationalist is. And then you must ask yourself, if you attempted to join the black Muslim movement, if that peculiar version of history is any truer or any sounder than the version of history which afflicts you now. We don't need any more myths. Let's try to tell the truth.
What do you think of Martin Luther King's nonviolent movement in the South?
Nonviolent in the South. What do I think of the Martin Luther King's nonviolent movement in the South? Well, I think two things. I'll try to be clear about it. I admire Martin very much, and Reverend King's work is incredible. And I personally am opposed to violence. I will say this too, that Martin has done tremendous work in the 6 years since Montgomery. And I don't think he could have done it in any other way. But if you remember what I told you earlier, everything must be questioned. The technique of nonviolence has obvious limits. It has this limit, that people are not by nature nonviolent. And it would cost you, if you were down there now, a terrible effort from which you might not recover. You have to endure what you would have to endure at the hands of those people. Therefore, your question, to be honest with you, finds me very much where you are. I think that the entire strategy has got to be rethought in order to minimize the damage to you. I have not yet come up with a satisfactory answer, but I will do my best. And you think about it too, okay? Little girl, yes.
Why isn't American Negro history taught as part of the Western education program?
Why isn't American Negro history taught as part of the Western educational program? Well, let me say something very rude, but this is the truth. The reason it is not taught is because a power structure, and all societies, as I said before, when I told the boy before, the difference between Europe and Africa was not that one was civilized and one was not, but that one had power and one did not. I meant it. That is also the reason that American Negro history is not taught. You were, at one time, and are still considered to be by many segments of this population, a source of cheap labor. If I am the white man and I have you in a certain place and I need you there, then it is important for me not to let you have any suspicion that you don't belong in that place. That is essentially the reason. Now, that's the root reason. There are reasons on top of it, but that is the reason at bottom. You see what I mean? Now, if I were your teacher, I would ask you to do me a favor and insist that you appear in those textbooks, even if they had to burn all the textbooks which now exist. I would insist on it, if I were you, for my sake, as well as for yours. You see what I mean?
And we are back. My name is Andrew Stewart. Again, we are Political Gingivitis, bringing you a special episode today devoted to the life and times of James Baldwin in commemoration of the amazing documentary that's just been released, I Am Not Your Negro, directed by Raoul Peck. I highly, highly recommend this film. It's one of the best that has been made in a long time. Not only in regards to the matter of race and racism, but just one of the finest documentaries made, period. Next up, we have a special treat. It is a lecture given by the great professor of Africana studies and scholar of the works of W.E.B. Du Bois, Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia. Stay tuned.
I want to thank everyone for coming out today to our first lecture on James Baldwin with Dr. Montero. Woo! here to Temple Department of African American Studies for over a year now. I was thinking when I came in this room that this is actually the room that Dr. Montero taught his race gen ed class from all of 2013 when I first met him. So it's just kind of surreal to be back in here and still fighting this fight. But you will see today during this interview why, I mean during this lecture, why we're still fighting this fight, why Dr. Montero's academia and his understanding of the world is so necessary for us to have at this school. And that's part of our general struggle. We're part of the coalition. We have a coalition for radical student power. And this coalition is fighting to make Temple the university that we want it to be. And that's not just about the amount of students that get to come here, or the type of students that get to come here, the financial aid that we receive, but it's also about the kind of education that we have when we're here at this university. As students, we should have a say in the kind of education we have, and the education should at some point reflect the students here. Now, we don't get that when we lose Professor Dr. Montero. We don't get to hear about the African-American experience. We have an African-American Studies department that doesn't even want to acknowledge that there is an African-American experience, which is why Dr. Montero is so invaluable to this university. And so I hope that through this lecture series, you will not only be enlightened, but you will realize the necessity for this struggle and why we have to fight for Dr. Montero to come back here. Because without him, who knows what's going to happen to this university? The history that he knows, his lived experience, is invaluable, and we need it back. And so with that being said, I'm just going to welcome Dr. Montero up here.
Much, Paul, and I'd like to thank all of you all for coming out. Yes, last semester, sponsored by many of the students who are here now, we did an 8-week lecture series on W.E.B. Du Bois. This time we're doing 4 weeks on James Arthur Baldwin. And all of you all know me as a big W.E.B. Du Bois person, and I am that. But the only person, thinker, that I put in the same room with Du Bois is James Baldwin. Yes. He is a really huge figure. Now, I was working with Navid on what we would call this series of lectures, and we decided on calling them The Immortal Child, James Baldwin in the 21st Century. Now, this concept of the immortal child comes from W.E.B. Du Bois, an essay in the book of essays called Dark Water. And he is writing about a young Afro-Caribbean British composer-musician named Samuel Coleridge Taylor. And Taylor died at a very young age, at 37 in fact, but he was a prodigy, a genius, who grounded his compositions in what Du Bois called the sorrow songs, these songs that speak to the yearnings for freedom of the diasporic Africans, especially in the United States. And Du Bois, when looking sorrowfully at this genius whose life was so short, asked the question, what is life and what is death? And what is infinity and how do we live on after death? And he says that we all live on through our children. So if the youth are strong, if they are educated, then the future is bright and we leave a legacy. And so when we thought about Baldwin, James Baldwin, We thought about him in these same terms, the great genius who died at the age of 63, but who is that immortal child. And one of the things we wanted to do is to bring him to Temple, to hopefully use him as a foundation of a student movement of a new intellectual renaissance here at Temple, led by students, led by what are in effect immortal children. But, you know, as we were preparing these lectures, we received very sad news about the situation of the great Mumia Abdul-Jamal and the fact that we almost lost him. And he is alive today only because of several very heroic women led by Pam African Johanna Fernandez, who refused to allow the state to take his life, in effect doing through medical neglect what they were refused to do through legal execution. So Mumia is alive in a weakened state, however, and we are fighting for his life. So these lectures are dedicated to the life and spirit of Mumia Abdul-Jamal. He said to Johanna Fernandez that he had always known that life was energy. And as he got into this weakened state as a result of diabetes, he almost went into a diabetic shock, and he felt his energy going down and he felt his life leaving him, he realized once again that life is this life force, this energy force. And so, you know, with our thoughts, with our actions, we hope to reinvigorate that life force in Mumia. And by invigorating it in him, we reinvigorate ourselves. Believe me, he is a force giving life throughout this world, in spite of the fact that he spent 30 years on death row and remains in the dungeons, prisons of North America. Let me just kind of read to you to start out what Du Bois said about the immortal child. Quote, "In the treatment of the child, the world foreshadows its own future and faith. All words and all thinking lead to the child, to that vast immortality and wide sweep of infinite possibility which the child represents. Such thoughts as this, it was made the master say of old as he saw baby faces," as Jesus. Quote, "And whoever shall offend one of these little ones, it is better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were cast into the sea," end quote. And yet, the mothers and fathers and the men and women of my race must often pause and ask, is it worthwhile? Ought children be born to us? Have we any right to make human souls face what we face today? Think of Walter Scott, South Carolina. The answer is clear. If the great battle of human rights against poverty, against disease, against color prejudice is to be won, it must be won not in our day, but in the day of our children's children. Ours is the blood and dust of battle. Theirs the rewards of victory. If, then, they are not there because we have not brought them into the world, we have been the guiltiest factor in conquering ourselves. It is our duty, then, to accomplish the immortality of black blood in order that the day may come in this dark world, when poverty shall be abolished, privilege be based on individual desert, and the color of a man's skin be no bar to the outlook of his soul. That's Du Bois. And it for me expresses what the great genius of the African-American people mean to the ongoing struggle of this wretched of the earth, who are the foundation and ultimately the guiding force for all progressive change, especially in this country. They suffer the most and do the heavy lifting in terms of changing the world. James Arthur Baldwin, perhaps the greatest essayist in the English language, matters because of his unconditional defense of humanity. He is one of the most original thinkers on racial and social matters. He matters because he uncovered the workings of the machinery of racism and its pedestrian and predatory day-to-day practices and assumptions. He matters because he rigorously demonstrated how modernity engages complexity and difference. He gave us the concepts and language to talk about and begin understanding the oppressive system of white supremacy in holistic ways. He probed its forms, its depths, its psychological and socio-psychological dimensions, its conscious and unconscious workings, its human devastation. Baldwin showed that the dialectics of racism conditioned the dialectics of the social order. Economic exploitation and inequality function within the boundaries it sets, not the opposite. White supremacy was, he taught us, far more than ideology and more than a derivative of the economic system, as Marx and his followers have claimed. He inverted the European Enlightenment's and scientific orthodoxies agreed to assumptions and logics concerning white folk, and even what sociological reasoning asserted about race. Race was neither natural nor normal. Whiteness itself was an abnormal and pathological reality birthed by the needs of the slave trade, slavery, capitalism, and European empires. However, like the HIV virus, it began to attack and take over the host from which it sprang. Brought into the world by slavery, capitalism, empire, and their existential necessities, white supremacy takes them over, and subtly and progressively, they become it. Rather than the system becoming a capitalist, imperialist, and white supremacist system, as we normally think of it, the system itself becomes a white supremacist system within which the machinery of capitalism and imperialism operate. In other words, the centrality of the color line in the determination of economic, political, social, psychological, aesthetic realities, not the opposite. It obviously produces its own racial, gender, sexuality protocols, meanings, and intersubjectivities. However, as we have seen in the 21st century, in reproducing itself, the system transforms, transfigures, and reconfigures itself in order to sustain itself. It does not just remain the same. Whiteness and white supremacy finally can be reinvented through new racial, gender, sexual identities, protocols, and practices. Yet the system remains what it is. A, quote, revolution thereby could overturn capitalism and its earlier identity practices without substantively changing the system. Its principal material essence would remain and be produced and reproduced even within a new, conceivably socialist economy with women's, gay, and trans equality, black civil and voting rights, and even a black president, in a new time and space era. I'm making all the sense in the world. A system which, in order to maintain itself, changes itself. But what remains is the fundamental essence of white supremacy. For Baldwin, a genuine revolution must ultimately overturn the system of white supremacy and the identity practices and existential meanings of whiteness. Baldwin would argue, almost like Du Bois, that as long as one's identity was as a white person, one could not conceivably transcend the existential boundaries of whiteness and the systemic framework of white supremacy. There is not and cannot, as he thought, be a revolution that does not destroy whiteness. However, a great irony defines this moment. The white supremacist system morphs and reconfigures itself by reconfiguring identities and its definitions and meanings of difference. These reconfigurations are mere changes in, not of, the system. Often changes that give life to it by transfiguring white supremacy and expanding the definitions of what whiteness and normality are. Too many such reconfigurative changes are an indication of an expanding personal freedom, political democracy, and the renaissance of civil society, by which I mean, for many people, gay marriage, a certain formation of a black, upper middle class, the acceptance of trans identities and so on, constitutes a renaissance of society and the emergence of a broader democracy, a wider civil society. And what Baldwin argues, and I am agreeing with, that such changes, as important to many as they might be, continue to occur within the boundaries of a white supremacist system. And hence, identities become, I am a white gay person, I am a white trans person, I am a white this and that. As soon as you put white on it, you have immediately trumped the possibility of that identity going beyond the bounds of white supremacy. Pop culture, pop art, and transgressive cultural and personal identity practice indicate for many people, especially those from the petty bourgeoisie, a substantive transformation of the system. It is argued that the trajectories of fundamental and revolutionary change will occur through the change of an expanding social space for multiple identities at one time considered transgressive, but in another period absorbed as part of the white normality. Ironically, however, rather than the dawn of a new revolutionary moment, these more or less superficial changes and expanding social and cultural space for them are but an indication of a system in decadence. What in Latin is called a memento mori, a reminder of death. It's one of the great ironies of this moment that so many people, especially those in the petty bourgeoisie, the educated elite, those who live now in the gentrified spaces of Center City, who consider it a signifier of a new democracy and a new freedom. In fact, all of this occurs upon the foundation of a intensifying and more decadent white supremacist system. It's one of the great ironies of this time. And so the frameworks of academic discourse that looks more at the intersections, quote unquote, of identities rather than the systemic foundations that underpin the overall system can see a revolution where, in fact, there is a crumbling, a decadence, a moment of systemic death, if that makes sense. The refiguring of what a decadent and dying social, cultural, racial, gender, sexuality, and economic relations, as well as the growing poverty and chaos of everyday life, especially for working people and the poor, in no way indicates the onset of a new and more human society, but its tragic opposite. And thus we see the separation of the aspirations and consciousness of the petty bourgeoisie who see freedom from society or societal constraints rather than freedom to transform society as their goal. Their consciousness and aspirations increasingly separate from the realities and inevitabilities of the lives of working people and the poor. Baldwin saw the start of the real American Revolution when Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, and the young radicals of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Panther Party focused their political practice upon exposing, clarifying, and attacking white supremacy and its many manifestations. Whiteness, while emerging in the specific time-space continuum of modern capitalism, nonetheless can outlive it, producing postmodern, even post-capitalist, white supremacist realities. Realities that can accommodate identity changes and changes in the way social differences are articulated without addressing the main problem, white supremacy and white identity. Baldwin saw and thought about these realities deeply. He thought in places far removed from normal and acceptable thought practice. Measured on multiple dimensions, he was an outsider, a fact he gladly embraced. His phenomenology, that is, his way of approaching knowledge and producing knowledge, was predicated upon an outsider-insider duality. He was substantially in, but not of, the space-time continuum of US and Western epistemological practices. This made him, in fact, prophetic, subversive, and really transgressive. He self-defined his social and ideological personalities. He was, as far as was possible, a self-defined human being. He acknowledged all of the various identities applied to him by the social and cultural systems that define the world he inhabited. None of them quite fit him, as he thought. He was a black gay man, quote unquote, in a white supremacist society. The race, class, gender, sexuality, preference, and intersexual matrices said something about who he was, but did not fit all of who he was and his possibilities. I'm not making this up either. He was, as he thought, even as a child, far more, as they say in the street, way more than the meanings of all those words separately or in some marginalizing combination when applied to him. For instance, many people who did not know him or never experienced him in person or through his novels, plays, and essays took shortcuts, defining him only as a gay black man. That combination of words and meanings, of course, then and now, although less so now, meant a broken, indeed pathological and dangerous person on every scale of human normality. He, of course, insisted he was a human and was not and would never allow himself to be anyone's definition of him, especially if the societal meanings of those words cursed, stigmatized, or stereotyped him. For instance, Eldridge Cleaver, a leader of the Black Panther Party and the famous essayist, in his book Soul on Ice, attacked Baldwin as inauthentic in black and revolutionary terms and inferred that Baldwin was a white man's tool to divert the black revolution. Cleaver insisted Baldwin was a petty bourgeois counter-revolutionary whose life was defined by what he considered desires that did not fit a black or revolutionary definition of masculinity. For Cleaver, homosexuality was a petty bourgeois and counter-revolutionary impulse. He called Baldwin a, quote, faggot. Jimmy responded by informing Cleaver in the essay to be baptized, Baldwin's essay, to be baptized, that he did not know what Cleaver's experiences were in or out of prison. But assured him that he was not one of the sissies, Baldwin's words, he had encountered in his life. Many of them, Baldwin asserted, had been broken on the wheel of life, still struggling not merely with their sexuality, but with their humanity as black men. But he counseled Cleaver that as a revolutionary, he, Cleaver, had more in common with Baldwin, because the artist and the revolutionary are driven by profound urges of love for their people, even when the people they love misunderstand them. But more than being a writer, Jimmy decided he wanted to be James Baldwin, whatever that was or would become. The characters in his novels and plays are like Dostoevsky's, complex subjects, products of unpredictable intersubjectivities and circumstances. Intersubjectivities mean the interactions of people, of subjects. So what I'm saying is, when you read Baldwin's novels, there are these complex intersubjective relationships that are also unpredictable. And that's what gives such great drama and great possibilities to his writing. He was able to write Giovanni's Room, a novel situated in Paris, where none of the characters were black and all of the main ones were homosexual or bisexual. He said, however, it was not, as many still believe, a gay novel. He said it was a novel about people attempting to find human community, generosity, empathy, and love, and how more than not they failed. That is the case while the places and racial identities and even sexual preferences were vastly different, for example, in Go Tell It on the Mountain, Another Country, Blues from Mr. Charlie, Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, and If Beale Street Could Talk, all very important novels by him. And just as it diminishes his intellectual, artistic, and philosophical enterprises to call his other novels black, it is just as misleading to call Giovanni's Room gay. Isn't that an irony? You can write a novel where the characters are gay and bisexual, and the writer of the novel said, but it's not a gay novel. It is a novel about human aspiration. And in the case of Baldwin, it is always that striving to find love, community, and human generosity. And his great achievement as a phenomenologist is to situate those strivings within the African-American lived world. And I would say to anyone seeking to understand the revolutionary potential, and in fact, the potential of the African-American people to bear such suffering and to still come back fighting, you can find part of the answer in Jimmy Baldwin's novels. That might be what he is to you, that is a gay black man, or society in which he lived, but not what he was, or for that matter, what he strove to be. Just as his life journey, in spite of every obstacle, was to be James Baldwin, which for him meant to be, it to be in the human, in human sense of free, self-defining and self-actualizing, so it was for his characters. His body of work is a type of multi-volume autobiography of humanity in the time of white supremacy. It is humanity writing its own autobiography in the time of white supremacy. It can be thought of as a form of humanity's self-narrative, told by a living, striving part of humanity. The narrative is about more than black folk, gay folk, or poor folk. They are the concrete forms he gives to the human. But it is about the complexities, tragedies, comedies, strivings, pathologies, failures that human experience, that human beings experience as they attempt to be human, while ironically trying to hold on to earlier forms that draw them back to inhumanity or prehumanity. He was completely honest and courageously principled when defining who he was. In a 1984 interview for the Village Voice with Richard Goldstein, Baldwin was asked, quote, "Do you feel like a stranger in gay America?" Baldwin's answer was progressive for then and now, although because of time, for different reasons. Baldwin's answer, quote, "Well, first of all, I feel like a stranger in America, from almost every conceivable angle, except oddly enough as a black person. The word, quote, gay has always rubbed me the wrong way. I never understood exactly what is meant by it. I don't want to sound distant or patronizing because I don't really feel that. I simply feel it is a word that has very little to do with me, with where I did my growing up. I was never at home in it. Even in my early years in the village, that is Greenwich Village, what I saw of that world absolutely frightened me, bewildered me. I didn't understand the necessity of the role playing, and in a way, I still don't." The interviewer returns to that question later on, asking, quote, "Do you think of the gay world as being a false refuge?" Baldwin answers, quote, "I think perhaps it imposes a limitation, which is unnecessary. It seems to me simply a man is a man and a woman is a woman. And who they go to bed with is nobody's business but theirs." Some people say it's a little bit antiquated, but we can debate that. "I suppose that I'm really saying is that one's sexual preference is a private matter. I resent the interference of the state or the church or any institution in my only journey to whatever we are journeying towards. But it has been made a public question by the institutions of this country." He went on to say that on all questions of identity and preference, he refused to think from within the language or the positionality or intellectual geography of the oppressor. And Baldwin would ask the question, and it seems to be a question that all serious black writers and thinkers in some way are asking. Can the English language bear the weight of black suffering? Can the English language bear the weight of black suffering? Baldwin, who has this enormous body of work, would say that the English language, even for him, limited his capacity to completely describe and explore black suffering. James Baldwin's mind was unsurpassed. He was as such a figure not of the past, but of our now time. He was and remains a thinker for us in what he called the long meantime, the time of America's long and terrifying racial counter-revolution. Frankly, this long counter-revolution goes back to the overturning of Reconstruction in 1877. And we are still living in, and in fact in an intensifying moment of America's long racial counter-revolution. The Great Revolution, American Revolution, was not 1776, it was 1860 to 1880. That's W.E.B. Du Bois. The overturning of Reconstruction, that brief period after enslavement, 1865 to 1877, began a long racial counter-revolution, which has not ended up to this day. And so Walter Scott, Trayvon, Eric Garner, whoever you name, these are casualties in this long racial counter-revolution. This enormous prison population is a symbol of this great American counter-revolution. James Baldwin called it the long meantime, as in the meantime, what do you do? And in the long meantime, what do you do? James Baldwin's mind again was unsurpassed. He's a figure of this time. He was and remains a thinker for us in what he called the long meantime, the time of America's long, terrifying counter-revolution. Amiri Baraka, in his eulogy at Baldwin's homegoing service, brilliantly observed, quote, "His spirit is part of our own. It is our feeling's completion, our perception's extension, the edge of our rationale, the paradigm for our best use of the world." And then Amiri concludes, "For Jimmy was God's black revolutionary mouth. If there is a God, and revolution his righteous natural expression, an elegant song the deepest and most fundamental commonplace of being alive." James Arthur Baldwin. I'll stop there.
That's all we got for the time for today, folks. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time for another episode of Political Gingivitis. I'm your host, Andrew Stewart, and I want to remind you again, America's greatest social democratic period corresponded with the lives of those wonderful commies, Larry, Curly, and Moe.